Welcome to this week's edition of Rust Belt Radio, the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center's weekly review of the news from the grassroots, news overlooked by the corporate media. The show airs every Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. on WRCT 88.3 FM in Pittsburgh, PA, and every Saturday from 5 to 6 p.m. on WVJW Benwood 94.1 FM in the Wheeling, West Virginia area. And we're also available on the internet, both on WRCT's live web stream at WRCT.org and archived at radio.indypgh.org.
On today's show, we will speak to Grady McFarlane, a former employee of the Lemington Center, about the recent closure and history of the center. We hear from members of the local group Food Not Bombs, who has been serving free vegetarian food to the Pittsburgh's homeless for about 10 years. The city of Pittsburgh is considering a new law to crack down on panhandling. We'll hear from local homeless about their view of the law. This past Saturday, young and old gathered in Oakland to march and rally against military recruiters, shutting down Forbes Avenue Army Recruiting Center for the day. And later in the afternoon, a crowd assembled in front of the Software Engineering Institute to mark the 60th anniversary of the use of nuclear weapons on Japanese civilians. And over the weekend, a jazz concert was held in East Liberty to raise money for a documentary to be released on the 10th anniversary of the Jommie Gamage killing by Pittsburgh police. Rust Belt Radio spoke to people there about the case and about police violence today. First, these local headlines from Pittsburgh Indie Media.
The statewide environmental group Citizens for Pennsylvania's Future, also known as Penn Future, is urging the State Department of Environmental Protection to move forward with stricter mercury regulations. Penn Future stresses the need for a state law regulating mercury emissions, especially because four of the top eight mercury-emitting power plants in the U.S. are in Pennsylvania. Some local legislators are resistant to tighter regulations because they feel that the federal guidelines are strong enough. Another concern raised by the regulations is the increase in electricity prices. In May, the Pennsylvania DEP filed a federal lawsuit along with 10 other states claiming that the federal rule is not strong enough and will not protect the public health. On August 16th, the DEP will go to the board and recommend that the agency move forward with creating new emission standards. If you are interested in finding out about your mercury level, the Sierra Club is hosting. Pittsburgh police identified mugshots of people charged with rape with the letter R. Doswell insisted witnesses identified him as the rapist only because he was the only mugshot with the letter R under it. His photo was marked because an ex-girlfriend had accused him of rape, but he was acquitted of that charge. Police officials say they no longer mark photos of rape suspects with an R. He was sentenced to 13 to 26 years in prison and maintained his innocence throughout the sentence. After Doswell was repeatedly denied parole and his appeals were unsuccessful, he contacted the Innocence Project. The Innocence Project is a nonprofit legal clinic at the New York Benjamin N. Cardozo School of Law that handles cases where post-conviction DNA testing of evidence can yield conclusive proof of innocence. In 1998, Doswell filed a request for testing but was denied because the motion was filed too late. In 2004, after confirming that the evidence from trial was located in the police department's property room, the Innocence Project and local counsel James DePasquale filed a motion to gain access to the evidence and have it subjected to DNA testing. Testing was granted in March 2005. The test results showed that the semen taken from the victim was not from Doswell. Quote, "These tests confirm what Mr. Doswell has been saying from the moment he was charged, that he was innocent and that this was a misidentification brought about by police officers who may have engaged in misconduct," said Colin Starger of the Innocence Project. After the results were returned, the prosecutors filed motions to vacate his sentence and release him. On August 1st, he was able to return home to his family and friends.
Nearly 10 years ago, Johnny Gamage was killed by police officers in Pittsburgh.
For white or black, Johnny Gamage was murdered. That was murder. And the courtroom just told me that it's okay for a cop, because he wears a badge, to kill my son, my brother, my father.
Beaten to death by five police officers in the Overbrook section of Pittsburgh, the case of Johnny Gamage divided Allegheny County and shocked people from across the world. From the beginning, race was a central issue. The five police officers implicated in Gamage's death were all white. Gamage was black. Although a racially mixed coroner's jury unanimously voted to indict all five officers, the first time that a police officer was ever indicted in Allegheny County, the eventual criminal trials were tried by jurors imported from the whitest corners of the state. The outcome of the case, two mistrials and one not guilty verdict, led to national outrage. As the 10th anniversary of the killing of Johnny Gamage approaches this October, Namo Productions and the Thomas Merton Center are releasing a documentary called Enough is Enough, The Death of Johnny Gamage. Sunday afternoon, the producers organized a jazz concert to raise funds to complete the documentary. The Gary Bartz Quartet formed The Challenge at the Kelly Strayhorn Theater in East Liberty. Matt Toops of Rust Belt Radio was there and spoke to organizers and attendees. First, Tim Veening of the Thomas Merton Center told us about the event and the importance of the memory of the Gamage case.
Well, the purpose of the event was to bring people together to raise some funds to complete the documentary Enough is Enough. That is a documentary on the killing of Johnny Gamage. It's going to be released by the Thomas Merton Center in conjunction with Namo Productions on October 12th this year. That's the 10th anniversary of the killing of Johnny Gamage. And we think it's extremely important because Pittsburgh is seen as a key part of the problem of police brutality in this country. And we think that this is an opportunity with this video to be part of the solution. We think it's very important that we need to be reminded, just like yesterday we remember the Hiroshima and the nuclear bomb. We need to be reminded of what happens when we allow a segment of our population to be dehumanized and scapegoated, whether that's the Holocaust, whether it's slavery, lynching, Matthew Shepard, or Johnny Gamage. And the reason we remember is so we do not make those mistakes again. In the area of police brutality, we have not learned our lesson. We continue to make the same mistakes. And so it's very important on the 10th anniversary of Johnny Gamage's death that it not be in vain.
Next, we spoke to two local women who appear in the documentary. They told us about their experiences demonstrating against police brutality in Pittsburgh 10 years ago during the Gamage case and their view of the problem today.
My name is Dorothy Urquhart. I was down there to demonstrate against the brutality and the killings that were going on and is going on in Pittsburgh.
Well, so where do you think we are now, and what do people remember from 10 years ago from the Gamage case?
Well, it's sad to say the conditions for the African American has worsened. Discrimination, racial discrimination is being practiced wide open, and in the brutality and the prisons being filled with the African Americans. And it's sad that they have created bills where men who can't work and aren't able to work on jobs because they're being discriminated against, like PennDOT and other government jobs that pay a decent wage. They're not hiring African Americans. The discrimination is wide open. So it's really a no-win position. They have put a lot of men in, and so they have the jails, prisons. Why not create jobs for these people instead of prisons? That's modern day slavery. So conditions have worsened.
My name is Yvonne F. Brown. I live in the Hill District. I can remember telling his mother and father that the reason why I relentlessly, day after day, was in front of the city county building speaking about Johnny Gamage is because I have a son that was the same age as him, and it could possibly happen. And history repeats itself. We are really devastating the whole world, not just my community. When we lose one person, you'd be surprised how many it affects. And it affected me really bad when I learned about Johnny Gamage. So all we can do is be a witness. But someone must speak out, or history will repeat itself, as it's done.
That was Yvonne Brown speaking about the Johnny Gamage case and police brutality in Pittsburgh. Enough is Enough, The Death of Johnny Gamage, a new documentary about the Gamage case, will be released on October 12, 2005, on the 10th anniversary of the killing.
On Saturday, there was a sizable demonstration against military recruitment in the war in Iraq. Gwendolyn Schmidt has the story.
On August 6, 2005, Pittsburgh Organizing Group held a counter-military recruitment and anti-war rally and march through the streets of Oakland. They started at Forbes and Bouquet for the rally during a hot summer morning.
Hi, everybody. I'm speaking not only as a staff person for the American Friends Service Committee, but also as a mother and a grandmother. I want our soldiers home. I want them here. I want them enjoying a long, lazy summer. I want them having a picnic. I want them going to a baseball game. I don't want them there making life and death decisions, seeing their friends maimed or killed, killing other people's children. We need them home.
I'm just your typical president in a typical predicament. Got a war to present and a secret to prevent from giving me a cowardly vent. To the guard I was sent by the firmament, but I spent my days getting bent. So when the government said I was absent, I said to that air guard,
but I will be free. My younger brother will be free. So keep going to war. I fucking dare you. We'll make it unprofitable. We'll make it impossible because we see through smoke. We see through the past to the future where my grandsons will play with dolls and help me in the kitchen and my granddaughters will dream of being warriors. But we won't even need warriors so they can dream about whatever they want. They can dream about the sun setting the sky on fire because they'll forget we had to set this world on fire. They'll wake up screaming from nightmares of men with badges who try to tell them what to do, and I'll run to them and I'll reassure them. I'll say, don't worry, child. Don't worry. There's no such thing as cops anymore.
Quite simply, there's a giant recruitment apparatus in place to tell a lie of opportunity, honor, valor, and sacrifice to your country, to sell an image, an idea that simply isn't true. Its tentacles reach throughout the aspects of our daily lives in a multitude of ways I think we're only now starting to comprehend. If you look at what things are like for a student in the public school system, as Whitney talked a little bit about before, you realize that how basically why people end up enlisting. You go to school and you go to homeroom. You have your teacher turn on Channel 1, the morning TV show, and you see ads for the military. You arrive at gym class only to find the recruiter will be taking over your class today, making you do drills and shouting military commands at you. You go to the guidance office to talk about where your life is going, and you're confronted with sleek brochures and posters for the military. Some schools even let recruiters set up tables right outside the guidance office door. Recruiters get extra money from the military each month for image projection. That's why they're driving Hummers to school, parking them outside. That's why they're wearing slick clothes and offering to take kids to restaurants and stuff like that. Because the military is giving them money each month just for stuff like that that normal soldiers don't get.
The march from the rally to the military recruiting office was short at 2 blocks, but the protesters filled the sidewalk with their chanting and marching. The recruiting office was closed for the day in anticipation of the demonstration. Later that Saturday afternoon, about 75 people gathered at the Software Engineering Institute, or SCI, on Fifth Avenue in Pittsburgh to mark the 60th anniversary of the only wartime use of nuclear weapons in history. On August 6 and August 9, 1945, the United States dropped atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The rally featured testimonies, poetry readings, and a performance by the Raging Grannies. Chalk shadows and photographs of the victims of bombings littered the sidewalks in front of SCI. At the end of the rally, Vince Irene, a longtime peace activist, dumped several hundred pounds of ash on the steps of SCI in an act of creative civil disobedience. He was not arrested. David Myron was there for Rust Belt Radio and spoke to Vince, who had been holding a vigil and fest in front of SCI since last Monday.
We're at the Software Engineering Institute run by the DOD and Carnegie Mellon University. I've been here fasting, sleeping day and night, hoping that God will develop in all of us some new appetites, as opposed for the appetite to kill one another and our enemy de jure by the U.S. of A. government. And we are here today because the 60th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Many people are here to speak. Banner, poster, leaflet, and at the end is going to be civil disobedience, where I'll be dumping hundreds of pounds of ashes on the steps of SCI, saying that people were incinerated at Hiroshima, and if CMU continues its work, we will be turned to nuclear ash. We break the law because it is the law that protects the injustice, whether it was lynching, Jim Crow, or Auschwitz, or Hiroshima, those were legal. They were, in fact, the law. And so, if we are not disobeying the law, we stand in a posture of obeying an unjust and unjust society. For years now, I have been in and out of prison, especially during the Cold War, remembering those that died at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I think that what has stuck with me the most, you might see the shadows around here, the Shadow Project. Some of the leaflets about that are on the front of the truck, is that many people at the center of the blast were incinerated. Ashes to ashes.
We shall
For more on all our local news stories, visit pittsburgh.indymedia.org.
You're listening to Rust Belt Radio, the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center's weekly review of news overlooked by the corporate media. We now turn to headlines from independent media centers around the world.
Last October, Rust Belt Radio reported on the FBI seizures of server systems used by 20 independent media center websites. The servers were located in London at a facility run by the company Rackspace. Rackspace took the servers offline without warning, shutting down indie media groups on three continents. The company claimed they were complying with a subpoena from the FBI, but that order was sealed. Represented by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, or EFF, Indie Media successfully sued the U.S. government to have the FBI seizure documents unsealed. A judge ordered the documents unsealed on July 20th, and last week documents were turned over. However, parts of the documents were redacted and are still sealed. According to the FBI, this letter they received from the Italian government, which led to the seizure, must remain sealed because, quote, the communique details with specificity the Italian national interest in keeping this matter sealed, end quote. The documents contain correspondence between the FBI and Italian authorities who used a treaty between the countries in an attempt to gain intelligence about a group that posted to the Italy and Indie Media's open newswire on their website. A new piece of information from the documents was revealed. The FBI did not ask Rackspace to turn over the Indie Media servers, but only asked for the web server logs. Indie Media no longer has any services hosted at any Rackspace facilities. All of the unsealed documents are available from the Electronic Frontier Foundation website at eff.org.
The Bush administration removed a key requirement from the 1994 Northwest Forest Plan last year, clearing the way for heavy logging by eliminating the need to survey forests for rare wildlife and plants associated with old-growth habitat. Now, a federal judge is challenging this move, saying the government, quote, violated the law by not fully analyzing the environmental effects of eliminating the surveys for endangered species. Judge Petchman's ruling could force reinstatement of this key element of the old-growth protection plan.
You can read more about our global news stories by visiting indymedia.org. In this week's Bad Cop No Donut, five men in Athens, Ohio accuse police officers of misconduct. An Erie, Pennsylvania officer has been arrested for assaulting his wife and her friend. The president of the police union in Easton, PA is suspended for calling the chief a derogatory name. And this week's Taser News.
This is Bad Cop No Donut for the week of August 4th, 2005. With your weekly wrap-up of North American police brutality, misconduct, and corruption, I'm Ron Anisich at CKLN in Toronto. Five men who were arrested by Athens, Ohio police in 2003 have filed a lawsuit accusing Athens police officers of misconduct. According to the Athens News, the five claim they were arrested and charged with reckless operation of a vehicle based on the word of a police department employee. The charge is a non-arrestable offense, but the five were arrested and detained for 90 minutes. During that time, the police employee who reported their conduct entered the room and laughed at them several times. The lawsuit claims that the men suffered a loss of freedom and liberty, mental anguish, humiliation, fear, inconvenience, and expenses, and also had their civil rights violated. The lawsuit also says the five were arrested and imprisoned falsely and is seeking compensation for damages as well as legal costs. An Erie, Pennsylvania police officer was arrested on Friday after allegedly assaulting his estranged wife and pointing a gun at her male friend. WJET reports that Officer Ed Dickens has been charged with simple assault, aggravated assault, reckless endangerment, harassment, and making terroristic threats. Dickens is accused of entering his ex-wife's home early Friday and physically attacking both his wife and her friend. He left, but returned later and threatened the friend again with a gun. The president of the police union in Easton, Pennsylvania, was suspended without pay for 10 days after he called the local police chief a derogatory name. According to the Allentown Morning Call, union president Dominic Maricini used the colorful language while criticizing the chief's decision to disband the department's SWAT team. That decision was taken after an Easton SWAT officer was fatally shot at a police station by a fellow officer.
Welcome back to Rust Belt Radio, the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center's weekly review of news from the grassroots. Mayor Tom Murphy's administration introduced a new ordinance to City Council last Tuesday that could severely restrict panhandling in the city of Pittsburgh. While the new proposal might please downtown business and cultural institutions, it may also raise civil liberty issues. The ordinance would ban panhandling near sidewalk cafes, street food vendors, bus stops, ATMs, and lines of people waiting for admission or tickets to events. It would allow people to ask passersby for money only during daylight hours defined as 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. during daylight savings time, and from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. during standard time. The ordinance would allow panhandling in public areas like alleys, bridges, driveways, parking lots, and entrances to buildings and dwellings. Panhandlers would be barred from a variety of aggressive actions, most of which already are illegal. Violations would be punishable by a $25 fine for first and second offenses, and a $50 fine for subsequent offenses in the same year. The legislation is a priority of downtown businesses, said Michael Edwards, executive director of the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership. Edwards commented, "We wanted to get some kind of ordinance that gives us enforceable and effective legislation that can keep downtown fun and help us attract business investment. We're trying to balance the rights of everyone downtown, including panhandlers." This ordinance proposal comes shortly after the Beggars Need Change, Not Coins ad campaign was initiated downtown. The ad campaign encourages people to give their money to organizations that provide services such as food and shelter to the homeless instead of money to the homeless themselves. The ads appear in Oakland, downtown, in playbills, and bus and tea placards. The sponsoring groups of the ad campaign include the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust, the City of Pittsburgh Bureau of Police, the Downtown Ministerium Walk-In Ministry, and the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership, who now also favors the panhandling ordinance. Mike Edwards of the Downtown Partnership said the impetus for the campaign came last year. Quote, "We had some surveying done, and many of our stakeholders, many downtown property owners, had noted an increase in panhandling activities and were sharing their concerns about how it's negatively affecting businesses. While the idea suggested by the ads has its merits, the true motivation for the campaign is made apparent by people such as Edwards, who simply wish to see the homeless disappear in order to make downtown more, quote, fun for tourists, arts patrons, and investors." Michael Stoops, executive director of the National Coalition for the Homeless in Washington, D.C., said anti-panhandling programs are often ineffective. He's familiar with similar programs in other cities and has found that the campaigns rarely have the desired effect. Dayton and Cincinnati have required panhandlers to get permits, as have other cities. In Orlando, they have tried prohibiting panhandling and registering panhandlers, neither of which have worked very well. "Rather than trying to keep people from giving, maybe we should ask why there are so many people begging on our street corners. Homelessness is increasing, and we think it's going to increase more because of cuts proposed by the president," Stoops commented. Anti-panhandling advocates have been pushing City Council to pass the ordinance. However, City Council has asked that civil liberty issues be further addressed. Their decision on the proposal is also pending a public hearing, which may occur next month. We spoke with a homeless person, Bill Andrews, about his thoughts on the panhandling proposal.
I think it's sad. You talking about panhandling hours. That's like working hours, like a 9-to-5 every day. That don't even sound right. For number one, nobody should be homeless in Pittsburgh anyway. Number two, those that are homeless, people claim, you know, you say get a job and get this and get that. You got a lot of people that got a lot of ailments. Mm-hmm. You got a lot of people that don't know about where to go to get things done. Help those that need, instead of talking about them, help them.
One of the sponsors of this new ordinance is, they're called the Pittsburgh Downtown Partnership. And from what it said in the Post-Gazette article was that their spokesperson said that he wanted to keep downtown attractive for investors and keep it fun. So to me, that sounds like having panhandlers and homeless people out on the streets takes away from a fun, attractive image of downtown Pittsburgh. What do you think about that?
I don't think what they're trying to create is for downtown people that's fun. It's for people that got money. If you don't have no money, you can't do nothing. Such as the rich, whether you're black or white, has no meaning of color. But say, for instance, those that go to Hines Hall, go to the Benningham for different events. You want to clean that area up because they live in Mount Lebanon, Dormont, Church Hill, areas that's way out, and they don't want them to run into that controversy. So that what they're doing, they're cracking down to get the people out of the way before the rich get downtown, or those that have money more than others, before these events start and after they start. And I don't think that's fair.
So are you kind of worried about what the future is going to be like for homeless people in Pittsburgh if they're trying to crack down on panhandling and things like that? What's your perception of the future?
It's going to be worse than it is. You're going to have a lot of people that's going to be in the mix or in the middle that really shouldn't even be in the middle, especially those that's already in desperate need, such as myself. And that's how I feel about it. It ain't gonna work unless they got a whole lot of cops that's gonna stay in a certain area. And once the panhandlers find out the certain areas they're gonna be at, they just go somewhere else.
It seems like they're kind of trying to look for a quick solution to panhandlers and street people instead of actually figuring out a way to reduce the number of people on the streets.
Exactly. And it's so sad. Like I said, nobody should be homeless, and nobody definitely shouldn't be hungry, not in Pittsburgh. But you got money for ballparks, you got money for this and that and the other, but you don't have money for the homeless, and that's not right.
On July 3rd, the historic Lemington Center closed its doors after 122 years. The Lemington Center was the country's oldest African-American nursing home and recently encountered financial difficulties and thus closed down. Grady McFarlane, a former employee of the center, spoke with Rust Belt Radio about the recent closure. His wife, Evelina McFarlane, also spoke with us about the history of the Lemington Center.
Hi, my name is Grady McFarlane. I'm a former employee of Lemington Center. Lemington Center, as you recently heard, closed down on July the 3rd. And I'm here, to discuss the closure. Well, as you know, Lemington Center was opened 122 years ago. It was founded by Mary Peck Bond for women that couldn't take care of themselves, you know, indigent poor women that had children, and she found a place for them to stay. And it lasts for 122 years.
It originated in the Hill District. Years and years ago, it originated in the Hill District, and it was just a two-room house. And it was for people, like he said, that was indigent, didn't have money, and couldn't take care of herself or whatever. And she took those people in. As it progressed over the years and people seen the involvement in it and the compassion that it was doing for the community, it expanded. And it moved to the East Liberty District off of Lincoln Avenue, which the place, Lemington Home, is still there. And it's a landmark. of the Leamington Center. It's placed by the church. It's on Lincoln Avenue and Neil Wilsey Street. Then after so many years there, they built a new building and moved it up the street, and which made it the Leamington Medical Center.
Mary Peg Bond had a vision. She had a vision for not just African-American, but anybody that wasn't able to provide the needs for the elderly, and, you know, without profiting off of their, you know, mishaps. It's a shame that we have to deal with profits off of tragedy, you know, in old age. Now, as of 6 or 7 months ago, the board of directors was determined to close the home down and file for bankruptcy. And actually what happened was before they even filed for bankruptcy, they were already talking about closure. The board created a culture of fear, you know, simply by telling people they were going to close, never gave it an opportunity to see if it was viable. We as a union and the people that own the property, which is called Touchstone, went before the judge to see if the Leamington was viable. At a particular time, the judge, not knowing the real situation, said, you know, we'll have a study, see if Leamington was viable or not. But in the meantime, the board of directors had started creating this culture of fear, you know, telling family members and going out and telling the community that they was going to close. They didn't follow the procedure as the way closing of a nursing home goes. Simply because you're supposed to give people 30-day notices, they started calling Heinz saying closure before they dished out the 30-day notices. Then we came back. The judge came back to ask them to do a study. The board hired an agency called Primus Care. Touchstone had an agent, had a man named Terrence Brown, who was also an outside consulting firm. They both came with the same conclusions, that Leamington Home was feasible. It would take 12 months to do it, but it could be done. But by the reaction of the board, causing this fear, people got panicked. The census went from almost 100 dropped down to about less than 50, all within a matter of 2 weeks before the board even gave its final notices out. And basically, that's how it, you know, started, made the snowball start to roll, and that came and brought the closure on much faster than most people thought. And in the meantime, though, the both independent consulting firms determined that this thing could work, but the board was determined to close the building for whatever reason.
Do you have any idea of why you think the board was determined to close it?
Well, because they caused a gross mismanagement, and they were, you know, just didn't want to be bothered with it anymore.
So what kind of mismanagement are you talking about?
One in particular, you know, when you have a nursing home and you bill for Medicaid, well, Leamington, obviously, it's been found that Leamington didn't bill for Medicaid for close to 2,000 days worth of care. So therefore, if you don't bill, you won't be paid for what you've done, which is one sign, you know, which is one way of losing money. And we as a union believe that it came up to about $500,000, which, you know, once again, if you're going to run a company, you should be trying to grow some, you know, regroup some of your money. And another instance of mismanagement was the fact that we had the union people, you know, the employees had a health care that was provided by Highmark Blue Cross Blue Shield, which in turn they paid a small percentage of the overall cost. When the employees were paying their percentage of the overall cost, management was using the money to pay something else. We didn't really realize that we didn't have any health care until one of the workers went to the hospital and she was denied health care. And that's when we found out that we didn't have no health care, which they hadn't paid into it for 6 months. So when I say mismanagement, I think there was true examples of mismanagement.
And what's the union that the workers are part of?
SEIU 1199P.
How is the board of directors chosen, and how long have the people that are on the board been part of the board of directors?
I couldn't tell you because we never had an actual sit down and talk about it. Mm-hmm. We've reached out. I've been there for 10 years, and we've reached out to the board for a number of times. How they're elected, I did not know. I mean, I couldn't tell you what they do. I mean, I know what a board is supposed to do, but
right.
I don't know what this board is
for. Okay. Do you think there's any hope of the Leamington Center reopening?
Well, apparently the board has chosen to go to a different direction. I think they're going to still use the Leamington name, but they have some ideas of their own, some home daycare situation for seniors. This is what I'm hearing, and, you know, I can't tell you that for sure.
Mm-hmm. Was it run as a somewhat of a nonprofit facility, and that's possibly part of the reason that the board is changing?
Yes. Yes, it was a nonprofit.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, once again, it's a shame when people want to use older people for profit. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going to try to provide care for your elderly people, say to me, we should try to take care of our elderly without trying to make money off of them. So, yes, it was nonprofit, and yes, they probably do want to make a profit.
Okay.
I hope they managed the money better than they did.
Can you talk about why it's such a historic building? Or I've heard that it was the oldest African-American
in the country.
Uh-huh.
Yes, it was. It was one of the oldest African-American nursing homes in the country. And once again, I said, like I started off saying, Ms. Bond.
So what will happen to all the people who lived at the Lemington Center?
Actually, they have been uprooted from their homes. A lot of them have been put place in other places, facilities, you know. Some of the residents that were there for 10, 15 years, you know. It became, we all bonded as one family.
Mm-hmm.
And so now they just spread it out all over the city.
Did they make a transition to other facilities for people?
Yes, that's required by law.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Evelina spoke about the closing of the center as a terrible tragedy and the important connections formed between employees and the senior citizens who lived at the home.
Homeless, elderly, and also the workers who devoted their time and patience and everything towards these people, because most of these people that's in the nursing home don't see their families as often as they see the workers. So they depend on the workers. They look at the workers as their family. So it was a great tragedy, and I'm just sorry it wasn't a lot of community effort involved in the petitioning work and the voice of mouth just spreading the word to try to save the Lemington Center, because what management did didn't have anything to do with the staff and the employers were doing. They were unaware of it. But like he said, when it snowballed and it came down, it was just a little bit too late for anybody to do anything at all. So if they do open it back up, it would be a blessing because it's a nice building and it could be used for something worthwhile. And just looking at what happened this time, I just hope in the future that people would think more about what they're doing other than themselves trying to profit, because people are living longer these days. People are living longer, and God forbid if any of their family members have to be placed in a situation like that. Would they want the place to close down and everybody to be booted all around to all kinds of overcrowded in different places?
Okay.
I'm just hoping that everything works out in the future for the building. Hope management learned something or feel something about, and the board of directors feel something about what has happened, because it was a tragedy. And for the employees, to keep the faith. You know you did a good job, and move on. God bless you.
Food Not Bombs is a worldwide organization that began in Boston, Massachusetts in 1980. In protest to the construction of a nuclear power plant and the proliferation of nuclear war, local activists worked to create awareness of the issue. The slogan, "Give Food, Not Bombs," emerged on street stencils placed around the city. In order to speak out against the amount of money spent on war and the amount of food that goes to waste each day in the U.S., a small group of activists then began collecting donated food and redistributing it to people in need. 25 years since the creation of Food Not Bombs, hundreds of chapters have developed across the Americas, Africa, Asia, New Zealand, Australia, and Europe. Cities and towns with the local Food Not Bombs group serve free home-cooked vegetarian and vegan meals to homeless and hungry people anywhere from 1 to 7 days a week. They make it a point to serve outdoors, in public, and without permission from any city or governmental authority. The chapters of the group are decentralized and autonomous, and Pittsburgh has its own group which has been serving food since 1994. Josh Leonard began helping with Food Not Bombs 3 years ago on Sundays. He also helped to start the Wednesday serving with friends 2 years ago. Josh discusses how the Pittsburgh chapter operates.
What does the group Food Not Bombs do?
Food Not Bombs salvages food that stores are going to throw away and cooks it and shares it for free with hungry people, anyone that wants to eat. Well, Sundays have been going for about 10 years, and Wednesdays have been going for 2 years.
And what's the response of people who come to the servings? What do they think of the group?
People that come to the servings tend to love what we do. And I guess the most interesting response is they always ask us if we're with a university group or what church we're with. And they always get surprised when they find out that most of us aren't students and it's just a group of friends doing this. It's not part of some large official group or church organization.
What do you think the difference is between Food Not Bombs serving food to homeless people and street people and the churches that come out and serve food or provide meals to homeless people?
We don't judge people, and I'm not saying that all the church groups do. I don't know. I think the atmosphere is a lot different. We just share food and eat with them. We just talk with them. The people that come to the servings are our friends a lot of the time. We get to know them. There's people that have been coming to servings every week for years now. So we've built friendships.
And what exactly is the meaning behind Food Not Bombs? I mean, other groups that serve food have a religious message behind it or something of that nature. What exactly is the message?
Food Not Bombs, the name, it came about because the United States government spends billions of dollars on warfare, and we think that money could be better spent on food. It's at the point now where not only do they not spend that money on food, but enough food gets thrown away to feed thousands and thousands of people in this country. It just doesn't seem that nutrition is a primary concern, and we have a problem with that. We think that those funds would be better spent on food, or even if not specifically food, just things people need to survive. People can't eat bombs.
Where exactly does Food Not Bombs get its food from?
We get our food from stores that are throwing food away because it can't be sold anymore because maybe there's some superficial blemishes on the fruits or vegetables, but they're still fine. Stores in the United States throw away enough food to feed so many people. It's kind of amazing. Before I did Food Not Bombs, I had no idea how much food is wasted in this country. And we take as much as we can get, but there's still so much food that gets wasted, it's ridiculous.
So there's really no need to buy food. You can find it through other ways.
We don't need to buy food, right? Stores throw away so much that we salvage enough. We've been salvaging enough for years. And the donations we get are just food that's going to be thrown away.
Does Food Not Bombs do anything else besides the two weekly meals?
Yes, Food Not Bombs serves at a lot of protests and conferences all around the U.S.
Can you talk about how Food Not Bombs is a national and global movement, not just located in the U.S.?
Yes, Food Not Bombs is all over the U.S. I've done Food Not Bombs in lots of cities, in Pittsburgh, of course, but also in Baltimore, Detroit, and even as far as California. And it's all around the country, and it's also all around the world. Like, they have Food Not Bombs all the way in Sweden, Australia, lots of places.
When and where does Food Not Bombs serve in Pittsburgh?
We serve every Wednesday and every Sunday. On Wednesdays, we're on the north side at Martin Luther King Elementary School at 6 o'clock. And on Sundays, we serve downtown at Market Square at 2:30.
What could someone do who wanted to join Food Not Bombs?
We can always use help, even if you can only do it a couple times. One of the biggest things is we need people that can drive. They don't even have to cook or anything. We just need people that can drive us to the serving location and back, and that's it. I mean, if people would like to help with cooking, that'd be great as well. Oh, it would also help to have people that know somewhere that might be throwing away food that we can use, like a grocery store. That'd be great.
We also spoke to Breen Casey, who has been active with Food Not Bombs for many years. So when did you start getting involved in Food Not Bombs?
1999, I'd say, is my best guess.
And what was the group like when you started joining up with it and helping out?
Well, back then we cooked at a house that had the nickname of the Peach Pit, and it was on the Boulevard of the Allies. When I started, they were mostly just letting us use their space. They didn't cook so much, but they let us, you know, use their kitchen. And it was kind of similar to how it is now. There were a few people who would come every week, and we'd get food from the co-op. And at that time, we cooked only on Sundays, so it was just once a week.
So you've been involved for about 6 years now. And have you seen changes in either the people involved or the people that come out to eat or the process itself? Have you seen any changes in Pittsburgh Food Not Bombs?
Some of the same people come out to eat and to help once in a while. It's kind of cool to go downtown to serve and see the same people that were there 6 years ago. I guess they rely on it, and that's a good thing. as far as people that serve, it seems like an ongoing change. Like people will do it for a few years and then kind of get burnt out or move on to other projects, and then more people come to take over.
Why do you think Food Not Bombs attracts so many people who are new to activism or, you know, new to these kinds of projects?
I think, for one thing, it's a really hands-on type of activism. Like, you cook and serve food that day, and that same day you see the positive results of it. So it's a really quick return, I guess, type of thing to do. And I think that attracts people. And plus, it's really open and inviting, and it's a good way to meet people and make friends. Most of the friends that I have, I met them through Food Not Bombs, and it's a good way to get involved in other things. Most people that do Food Not Bombs are pretty activist-oriented in general and take part in other projects and things like that.
So you see Food Not Bombs as a community-building activity?
Yeah, sure. It's a great way to meet people and get involved in different types of things, sure.
Have you been involved in Food Not Bombs in other parts of the U.S., or have you ever traveled to other cities and seen how their Food Not Bombs works?
Yeah, I went to Food Not Bombs in California, and it was amazing. It was really well organized, and a lot of older people were involved there. They just seemed to have, like, a really smooth operation, and they served, like, a ton of people. And in Portland, Oregon, they serve, I think when I was there, they served like 7 days a week, and that was really impressive. They had a lot of people come to eat on certain days. I lived in Kansas for a while, and we did Food Not Bombs there, and that was fun. It was similar to this, but it was a lot smaller. It was a small town, and you know, we would only serve maybe like 4 or 5 people a week, but it was still fun to do, and it was, you know, it was good for those people who did come and eat.
So, Food Not Bombs is a growing movement around the world. I know new chapters are starting in new countries. New chapters are starting in smaller cities all the time, not just in, you know, the big cities like Boston, cities in California that already have their Food Not Bombs established. But Food Not Bombs has been going for 25 years now. And what do you see in the future for the Food Not Bombs movement or for the work that's done here in Pittsburgh?
Well, I hope that it can continue to grow throughout the country, throughout the world. I hope that here in Pittsburgh, I mean, I think there's a lot of people that are interested in, like, activism and homeless issues and things like this, and my ideal would be finding a good, permanent, convenient place to cook and finding more people to volunteer and trying to do it more days a week, because I think in this city, if things were, you know, if things were organized and maybe promoted right, I think it could be pulled off that we could do it more days a week here. That would be kind of a personal ideal, I guess. That would be nice.
And do you have any personal Food Not Bombs story or memory, something that's happened in your 6 years of organizing and volunteering, anything that stands out? I'm sure you've met and served hundreds of people in those years.
Oh, yeah. There are some great people and people that I really enjoyed having conversations with and talking to, and a lot of times homeless people are sort of ignored or considered crazy and people don't really listen to them, and some of them are very crazy, but some of them are really intelligent and wonderful and just fabulous to have conversations with. My favorite Food Not Bombs memory is when there was this time, I don't know, maybe 4 years ago, 5 years ago, but the cops came 1 week and they told us that we weren't allowed to do Food Not Bombs anymore. And
which location was that at?
It was in Market Square downtown. It was around the same time that Mayor Murphy was trying to push the Fifth and Forbes project, where he wanted to put in all these bougie fancy stores downtown and make it like this super fancy place, and it never really happened the way he wanted to. But it was during that time that the cops came out and told us to not come back next week or they were going to arrest us all. But we came back next week and we called everybody we knew, every organization that we had any connection to, and we also called the local news media and invited them all to come out. So there was like a huge festival downtown, and when the police came, they just didn't do anything. And then there's the news reports that kind of made them look foolish. The news really swayed in our favor and presented them as these cops who were trying to stop do-gooder kids from feeding people, and it worked out perfectly. And the mayor was on the news and the police were on the news saying that they didn't know what this was about and they had no problem with us and that we'd be fine, and they've never come back yet.
Volunteers such as Josh and Breen spend hours each week preparing the meals. After two or more hours have gone into chopping, baking, and cooking, the food is ready to be served.
What did you guys make today?
We did a stir fry. We made some white rice and beans. Tastes really good.
So you think the people downtown are going to like it?
I hope so. It's healthy food, so that's good.
The group arrives at the serving location, hangs up their banner, and instantly several people begin to gather around the food, saying hello and asking what is on the menu for the day. The crowd is a mix of newcomers and regulars. Some of the people have been coming to the servings for years. For others, it is their first time sharing a meal from the group. Keith Schmidt is one such person. He and his wife, Missy, found themselves out on the streets a few months ago. Keith describes his experience with Food Not Bombs in Market Square.
You came out to Food Not Bombs a few months ago. I remember you coming to this serving. Can you tell us why you came out and what it did for you?
Me and my wife were just walking along. We were hungry, starving, actually. They treat women better than men. So she could eat, but I couldn't.
You're referring to the shelters?
Yes, and we came down here on a Sunday, and my stomach was killing me, and we ate. Then we started coming every Sunday for like a month straight, and now everything's going great. We got a place to stay, food in our bellies every day, fridge is packed. But for that month, I needed that service. It was there, and it saved my butt.
So it just helps you get by when you needed it.
When you need it, it's there, and it really did. It really helped a lot. It did.
Did you see any difference between coming out to the servings at Food Not Bombs and the food that you would get in the shelters that you and your wife were staying at?
Well, my wife, she got fed good, but the men's shelters, they feed you slop. It was the best meal I had had in a week, and the men's shelters, they feed you crap. You guys have been given great food. I mean, you know, food, it was good. I wanted to eat it. It wasn't that I had to eat it because I was starving. Even though I was starving, it was good food.
Could I ask you about what you think of the group Food Not Bombs that's out here right now serving food?
I think that's a blessing. That's more than the heart can even say, because you don't have to do it. You could be doing something else. But you take the time out in your life on certain days to come downtown in Market Square to feed people that you know need some need. I look at the restaurants, Wendy's, McDonald's, Arby's, they can sit sandwiches out for certain hours, throw them in the garbage, but they won't give them to people. Why throw them away? Give them to somebody that might want to eat it, like me. Because I done been in garbage cans. I done ate out of garbage cans in bags where rats been at. And I know rats are there. And you taking the chance every time you go in one of them alleys in a can or a bag. But you don't know what you going to run into. But I try to get something that's wrapped up and ain't been tampered with and try to make a meal.
That was Bill Andrews, a homeless man who has come to eat the Sunday meal, and he says that Sunday is the hardest day of the week to find food downtown, and for him, Food Not Bombs fills in a crucial gap in the week to provide free meals to hungry people. With crackdowns on panhandling and increasing poverty in the city of Pittsburgh, more people rely on the necessary service provided by Food Not Bombs. The combinations of warfare, militarization, and capitalism create a world where Food Not Bombs is necessary. While many members of the organization work to fight against hunger, homelessness, and social isolation, the movement continues to grow here in Pittsburgh and across the globe. To get involved with Food Not Bombs, you can call 412-352-9387 or 412-621-2371.
Thanks for tuning in to Rust Belt Radio here on WRCT Pittsburgh and WVJW Benwood. Our hosts this week are Carlin, Gwen, and Andalusia, with contributions from David Myron. This week's show was produced by Matt Toops. Special thanks to all our hosts, producers, and contributors. Your story submissions are welcome. To get involved with Rust Belt Radio or to send us your comments, email radio@indypgh.org. All of our shows are available for download on our website at radio.indypgh.org. Tune in next week at this time for another edition of Rust Belt Radio, the Pittsburgh Independent Media Center's weekly review of the news from the grassroots.